may be a spent force, which was our point in the editorial. He was really past. We had recognized here that he was a destructive force. But one never knows these days in politics. You know, Donald Trump proves the old saying, anybody can be president. Proves it in not a very good way, I would say.
Linda Valdez, I want to thank you for being with us, editorial board member, columnist at the Arizona Republic, the state's largest newspaper. After President Trump pardoned Sheriff Joe Arpaio, she wrote an editorial. We'll link to that. Donald Trump just resurrected Joe Arpaio from irrelevance. Linda Valdez is a Pulitzer Prize finalist. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Dina Gunter, and Irene Shea, Carla Rose, Laura Gattis, Dina Sam Alcoff. I'm Amy Goodman with Renee Feltz.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 7th Annual Arab Festival, Saturday, September 2nd at Oaks Amusement Park in Portland. The 7th Annual Arab Festival will feature delicious, authentic cuisine, music, dance, poetry, fun activities for all ages, and much, much more. Admission is free. Again, that's the 7th Annual Arab Festival, Saturday, September 2nd from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. at Oaks Amusement Park, 7805 Southeast Oaks Parkway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Have you received your KBOO Silent Drive letter in the mail? Here is your chance to support your favorite community radio station and enter a chance to win some fabulous prizes. No letter? No worries. Go to kboo.fm to find out more about what you could win when you donate to KBOO between now and September 14th. Here is a teaser. The grand prize is a week stay at El Dorado Resort and Casino with airfare in the biggest little city in the world. Yes, that's Reno, Nevada. The first prize is a night out on Burnside with a night at Jupiter Hotel, with dinner at Le Pigeon, drinks at Cedar Riot, and breakfast at Grendel's so you can dive deep into the Burnside nightlife. And our second prize will allow you to stock up on medicinal and recreational treats at Jane PDX. Go to kboo.fm to donate. When we come together, we build our community's resilience, and there is no better time to invest in KBOO than now.
The time is 5:01 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News. This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from Yon Mini Storage, offering storage for home or business, short-term or long-term, in any size from a closet to a garage. Yon Mini Storage is located at 3055 Northwest Yon Avenue in Portland. More info and reservations at 503-827-3900 and yonministorage.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, rains and flooding from Hurricane Harvey continue to plague the Gulf Coast. We bring you a report from a correspondent in Houston, Texas.
The administration announced today that it is removing restrictions from the 1033 program, which allows local police agencies to get military equipment, including weapons and armored vehicles.
And anti-racism activists have begun a march from Washington, D.C. to Charlottesville, Virginia.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 28th, 2017. I'm Natalie Motti.
And I'm Ken Jones. Dozens of wildfires are burning in Oregon today, consuming over 300,000 acres of private, state, and federal forest lands. 5,000 acres of forest lands are currently burning in Washington state. The state of Oregon usually spends around $34 million fighting forest fires. So far this year, the cost has been over $100 million. The Jones Fire, which started in steep mountainous territory in the Willamette National Forest on August 12th, has grown to 6,000 acres and is 30% contained. At times, its smoke column has risen to 25,000 feet, visible with satellite imagery. The estimate for fighting the Jones Fire has jumped from $5 million to $10 million. Firefighters addressing the Millie Fire west of Sisters, Oregon, are applying innovative techniques to deprive the fire of fuel and lower its intensity as it continues to spread. The fire grew by an additional 4,000 acres over the weekend.
Aircraft are being used to drop ping pong ball sized incendiary devices over areas deemed likely to burn, thus starving the fire of wind-blown spread. The National Weather Service has posted a red flag warning for the Portland area, meaning that conditions are now favorable for rapid fire growth. The warning remains in effect until at least 8 o'clock this evening.
A new report compiled by the state of Oregon shows the state experienced a 6% increase in homelessness over the last year and a half. The federally mandated report also showed that Multnomah County had an almost 10% increase in the number of people living on the streets. The report pointed to high rents and low entry average wages as a prime culprit for the increase in homelessness. The state of Oregon's findings confirm a report released earlier this year by the National Low Income Housing Coalition, which placed Oregon as the fourth most unaffordable state for housing in the country.
The city of Portland, in conjunction with Multnomah County, is considering building a new permanent 200-bed shelter in the Old Town Chinatown neighborhood. The houseless new shelter would be the eighth in that district and the largest, and would offer additional services including job search help and counseling services. The Joint Office of Homeless Services, a City of Portland and Multnomah County joint agency, has increased the number of beds at area shelters from 658 2 years ago to the current 1,300 beds. The 1,300 beds is far short of the at least 4,200 houseless people that a federally mandated report recently showed are living in the Portland area. The three-story building located at Northwest 4th and Hoyt would need extensive remodeling to be habitable. The Old Town Chinatown Neighborhood Association has not taken a stand on the issue, but will wait for two public meetings before deciding whether to support the shelter or not. The public meetings are scheduled for September 6th. The first will run from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the University of Oregon, 70 Northwest Cooch Street, and the second will be held at the Central City Concern Old Town Recovery Center. That's at 33 Northwest Broadway, and that meeting will run from 6 to 7:30 p.m.
The Gulf Coast of Texas was hit hard by Hurricane Harvey over the weekend, and rains continue to pound that state. The city of Houston, in particular, has been hammered by Harvey. At least 8 people so far are reported to have died in the storm, and tens of thousands have been displaced and are staying in emergency shelters. The storm is continuing to dump rain on the area, with several more inches expected to hit Houston and the Gulf Coast over the next few days. KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Dean Becker from the radio station KPFT in Houston, Texas, to find out more.
Dean Becker is a reporter and public affairs producer at radio station KPFT in Houston, Texas, one of the Pacifica sister stations. And Dean, gosh, are you okay? That's the first big question.
Well, we're one of the lucky ones. We watched the squalls come through. It would rain like hell. There's only one way to put it. It was raining 2 and 3 inches per hour. We're lucky we live on a house that's about 3 feet above street level, which is kind of rare in Houston. 6 or 8 times the squalls filled the street where it was 3 feet deep, 6 inches or so from coming in our house. We sat on the porch and watched this happen and just prayed. And, you know, I ain't a praying man, but I did this past couple of days, I'll tell you. We live in the older part of town. What has happened here is that as they build further and further out from the city central, they pick on lower lands, farm lands, in some cases you might even call it swamp lands. And the houses that got flooded the most are those on the outskirts of town, north, south, east, and west. They built a new city about 10 miles east of Houston called Katy. And it's now filled in all the way from Houston to Katy. But they just got the worst of it. Just last night, my son lives out there. They got their cars flooded. They got an inch or two in the house. And again, they're amongst the lucky ones because there are people who live in two stories where the bottom story is full. People having to hide in attics. Sometimes people die in those attics because they don't get found and they can't get out. But it's been hell, Doug.
This morning, Harris County and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers announced that the Corps was going to be opening up a couple of the reservoirs. They're filling faster than they can release the water, but they're trying to hope to prevent the dams from going. There are neighborhoods that are going to be underwater as a result. Is that right?
Yes, it is. And again, those were built, you know, later. Those are some of the newer, more modern homes, more expensive homes, $250,000, $500,000 homes. And the way I understand it, they're going to release enough water. They're in there forcibly bringing people out of those houses because there's going to be 6 or 8 feet of water coming in. And that's for the better good, you know, the better good that more of us will live than because if that dam breaks, it's, oh, Lord help us.
So, did you have electricity? I mean, I'm talking to you, so you obviously have cell. How's...
No, we're amongst the lucky ones. We had electricity throughout. We had good cable. We got good internet. We had a lot of fear, you know, when that water's lapping at your front door 6 or 8 times in 24 or 36 hours, it gets you thinking. And... But we've been lucky. We just went out today, took a tour of our neighborhood, the Spring Branch area, if any of the listeners know what that is, Spring Woods, almost down to Memorial. We determined we weren't going to get on any freeways. We came up to the edge of certain freeways. The problem here is if you get on a freeway, there may not be an exit because there's so many areas that are inundated. There's cars bobbing in the water in many of the intersections. So it's I'm glad to say, you know, 1 out of 20 stores is open. The big ATV grocery store was open. There was nowhere to get into the parking lot. People were circling to get into the parking lot of that store. Our favorite restaurant, Whataburger, shuttered up, but there was a couple of donut shops open, but maybe 1 out of 30, 1 out of 50 businesses is open at this time. Minor water, you don't want to be in the right lane on most of these streets. There's still water on most of them. But we didn't encounter anything. It was raining real hard as we were out driving, and we were worried we wouldn't be able to get back in the driveway, but luckily our street was still navigable.
Katrina was years ago. People hope that officials at the state, local, and federal level would learn something. How has been the official response, and how are people feeling about it?
Well, I'm sure there's going to be those people wanting to point fingers at the mayor and, you know, the county commissioners or whoever. But the truth of the matter is, you know, I'm going to put an aside here before I really respond. I used to surf. I used to travel up and down the coast following hurricanes because that's our only real surf we get here. But the point I guess I'm wanting to get to is that never have I seen anything like this hurricane, to run into a high there on the south of Texas, to stall and to have that dirty side band come to our city for days on end. That has never happened before in my experience, and I understand that this is not a 10-year, 50-year, 100-year, 500-year flood. This is an 800-year flood. This has never happened before in anybody's experience, this type of situation developing. So with that in mind, I'm not going to point fingers at the mayor. I'm going to praise him for what he's tried to do, for the lives he's tried to save. This is not like Katrina.
And in case people can't tell from your accent, you are from Texas. You've been living in Houston for a good long time.
Been down here since 65.
KPFT is still broadcasting. I checked in before the I checked. Is it on high ground or is it using a?
Well, it's up on stilts more or less. the house is that it's, you know, it is the studio has a 1, 2, 3, but a 3-foot step up to get in it, and the winds haven't been blowing that hard, not like, you know, a hurricane. It's been, I don't know, 50 miles an hour, so the transmitter didn't blow over, the house didn't implode, and in our drive around this end of the city, we didn't see any fallen trees, a couple of branches, a lot of leaf litter and you know, a few high water marks where the water had risen. But in general, this end of town or our section of town got by real good.
Right on. Well, I'll let you get back to it. I just, you know, you're in our prayers, and stay safe and hope those dams hold.
Well, I thank you, and, you know, this is going to be certainly tens, maybe hundreds of billions in damage. Our mayor said this morning, it's not going to be days or weeks in recovery. It's going to be many months to do so. We got 30,000 people in the shelters now, and wouldn't surprise me if it's going to be several times that before this is done. Thank you for paying attention to this, Dylan.
Oh, Dean, thank you. And again, just stay safe. Stay dry, brother.
All right.
Just again, we've been speaking with Dean Becker at, in Houston, Texas, news and public affairs producer at KPFT-FM in Houston, Texas, and there in the middle of Harvey. This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
A list of relief agencies and charities providing emergency relief services in the Houston area can be found at the website news.infoshop.org. The link is at the top of the page. Or just search the site using the keywords Hurricane Harvey.
And now from our friends at H2O Radio, it's the Week in Water.
One of the worst flooding disasters in U.S. history. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report about water. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water.
Hurricane Harvey hit the Texas coast on Friday night and Saturday morning. The storm lost some, but not all of its destructive wind, and was dropping huge amounts of rain, in some places 4 to 6 inches per hour.
As of Sunday morning, the storm was producing rain bands that have stalled over the Houston area, producing widespread flooding.
Some estimates show that in the last 24 hours, the rainfall has exceeded the average amount Houston gets in 6 months.
Patrick Blood, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service, told the Houston Chronicle that the storm is catastrophic, unprecedented, epic, or whatever adjective you want to use. Forecasters are saying that another 20 inches is possible in the coming days.
About 1,000 people were rescued overnight. Emergency management in Houston advised people to climb onto roofs, not into attics, unless they had a way to get out or an axe to cut through.
The U.S. Coast Guard has 8 helicopters helping with rescues and is calling for additional resources from other government agencies.
At this time, there were reports that 5 people have died in the storm, but only 2 have been confirmed.
Predictions from the National Hurricane Center on Sunday morning showed it was possible the storm could move south from its current location, back over the Gulf of Mexico, and then return toward Houston.
Recently, the Trump administration lifted a ban on sales of plastic water bottles at some national parks, which was started 6 years ago by Obama's Interior Department.
The policy was aimed at lessening the amount of plastic garbage. At the Grand Canyon, plastic bottles comprised 20% of the park's total waste and contributed much trash below the rim.
The Washington Post reports that the Park Service spent millions of dollars to install water stations for reusable bottles. Zion National Park estimated that its sales of them increased nearly 80% after it banned bottled water sales.
But Trump's Interior Department said the ban had removed the healthiest beverage choice while allowing sales of sweetened drinks. The department statement reiterated arguments made by a bottled water trade association, which includes members like Nestle.
Lauren DeRusha Flores of Corporate Accountability International told SFGate that the industry set up a false choice between sugary drinks and bottled water, and that the old policy increased access to free tap water and promoted reusable bottles.
The Trump administration announced that it's stopping a study being done about the health effects on people who live near surface coal mines in central Appalachia.
The study was being done by the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, and was started last year to analyze the effects of removing tops of mountains to expose coal seams. The removed rubble is dumped into nearby valleys and streams and can affect air and both surface and groundwater.
A Duke University professor told PBS that for every meter of coal obtained, almost 100 meters of rock has to be put somewhere, and most of it ends up in river valleys. And a researcher from Indiana University told Congress in 2015 that coal from mountaintops releases pollutants that cause cancer, cardiovascular disease, and birth defects.
The aim of the Obama administration study was to safeguard the health of residents near the mines. According to Earth Justice, more than 2,000 miles of streams and headwaters have been permanently buried and destroyed.
The Interior Department said that it stopped the study to determine if it was a responsible expenditure of taxpayer funds.
Bill Price of the Sierra Club told the Washington Post that it's infuriating Trump would halt the study that people in Appalachia have been demanding for years.
Recently, thousands of Atlantic salmon escaped from a fish farm off the coast of Washington, and some people, including local Native American tribes, are concerned the farmed breed may threaten native Pacific salmon.
Fish farming is done using large pens made of nets that are placed in ocean waters. The nets at Cook Aquaculture, which contained more than 300,000 Atlantic salmon, collapsed, releasing what was thought to be no more than 5,000. But last week, the company said the actual number is much higher, according to the CBC.
The Lummi Nation, a local Native American group, declared a state of emergency last week due to the escaped fish. They said in a statement that they hadn't heard the spill was contained.
State of Washington officials have put the Atlantic salmon on its list of invasive species considered to be highly threatening. The non-native salmon could harm native fish stocks by competing for food, preying on the Pacific salmon, and spreading disease.
Local citizens are being asked to help to catch the escaped fish. The head of the Washington State Department of Fish and Wildlife is encouraging anglers to catch as many of the Atlantic salmon as possible. And finally, speaking of fish, happen to have a goldfish at your home or office? Well, if you don't clean its bowl frequently enough, it gets murky and a bit unpleasant to look at. But worse, it's also running low on oxygen, which fish need to survive.
But according to new research, goldfish and their cousin, the Crucian carp, have a survival mechanism that helps them cope in oxygen-starved waters.
Most fish, as well as us humans, take in oxygen into our cells to release energy. Without it, we'd be toast in a matter of minutes. In a pinch, the body can produce lactic acid to create energy using glucose instead, but it's only for short bursts of activity, like doing a sprint, and that's what makes our muscles hurt and burn.
But goldfish and Crucian carp have a unique ability to take that lactic acid and convert it into ethanol. That alcohol is then diffused across their gills and released into the water around them, allowing the animals to survive for months on end without oxygen.
So, for that goldfish to survive in your child's murky fish bowl, it's hitting the sauce, big time.
According to Michael Barenbrink, co-author of the study, carp in ice-covered ponds can have blood alcohol concentrations of more than 50 milligrams per 100 milliliters, which is above the limit to drive in most countries.
We don't have to worry about goldfish getting behind the wheel, but now we know why they probably don't get bored swimming through that castle over and over again. They're probably feeling pretty happy. This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association. Discuss your water infrastructure challenges and solutions at WIC 17, October 30th through November 2nd. Find out more at awwa.org/H2O Infocon.
Now from the Yale Center for Environmental Communication, it's Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When companies decide where to open a new plant or office complex, they consider lots of factors, like tax incentives, regulations, the cost of living, and the available workforce. And now, some companies are weighing an additional factor, whether a location can help them go green.
Close to half of the Fortune 500 companies have clean energy goals that they've put on the record already, and that's been growing very quickly. So this is part of the language that everybody is speaking now.
That's Brian Wheeler, spokesperson for Consumers Energy, a Michigan utility. He says that when a company called Switch was looking to open a new data center in Michigan, one of the company's priorities was to be powered entirely by clean energy.
We said, yes, we will honor that commitment and do that. In the case of Switch, we have an existing wind park in the state that we are expanding to meet their needs.
In the hopes of attracting more companies like Switch, Consumers Energy is seeking state approval for a new program. It would enable the utility to meet the renewable energy needs of any large company looking to set up shop in the state.
If Michigan wants to compete for new businesses and large businesses that are going to put a lot of people to work, it's important that we have the tools to offer them.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Following tonight's newscast at 6, it's Labor Radio, radio of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class. That's followed at 6:30 by Prison Pipeline, dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, a heat advisory remains in effect until 8 p.m. today. Patchy smoke, but otherwise clear, with a low later around 66. Tomorrow, Tuesday, sunny, with a high near 89. The quote of the day is from Nelson Mandela, the political activist, freedom fighter, and first black president of South Africa, who said, "A critical, independent, and investigative press is the lifeblood of any democracy. The press must be free from state interference. It must have the economic strength to stand up to the blandishments of government officials. It must have sufficient independence from vested interests to be bold and inquiring without fear or favor. It must enjoy the protection of the Constitution so that it can protect our rights as citizens."
On this date, 54 years ago, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his famous "I Have a Dream" speech from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial to over a quarter million civil rights supporters. Many consider the speech to be one of the defining moments of the civil rights movement. Here, then, is a portion of that remarkable speech.
"No, we are not satisfied, and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I am not unmindful that some of you have come here out of great trials and tribulations. Some of you have come fresh from narrow jail cells. Some of you have come from areas where your quest for freedom left you battered by the storms of persecution and staggered by the winds of police brutality. You have been the veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive. Go back to Mississippi. Go back to Alabama. Go back to South Carolina. Go back to Georgia. Go back to Louisiana. Go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities, knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed. Let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friend, so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Yeah. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama, with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, and every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is a faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, 'tis of thee." Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrims' cry. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. And so let freedom ring. From the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, let freedom ring. From the mighty mountains of New York, let freedom ring. From the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, let freedom ring. From the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, let freedom ring. From the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, and when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
That again was the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. delivering his I Have a Dream speech, which took place 54 years ago today.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers Local 701 Auto Mechanics are entering their second month of their strike at 185 Illinois auto dealers. Local 701's Sam Cicinelli says a big issue is auto mechanics' wages getting shortchanged roughly 6 hours a week. That's because the dealers and automakers have lowered their book times for repairs, and the actual repairs take longer to do.
We are looking to shorten the gap on approximately 6 hours that go uncompensated for mechanics that are on the clock for 40 hours. It's 15% that they forego of their wages per week. In some cases, a lot of cases, they're on the clock for upwards of 50 hours trying to make book time to at least go home with a 34-hour check.
Cicinelli says that federal mediation sessions are attempting to help reach a deal to end the strike. He says the 1,944 striking Local 701 mechanics have gotten a lot of public support and backing from other unions. Cicinelli says the striking mechanics are unified and their fight is a middle-class workers' fight, and they want to thank the public for supporting the strike.
This is a middle class ringing the bell to keep the middle class preserved. We're fighting their fight. We're fighting everybody's fight, even the ones that don't have a voice in the workplace. So thank you so much for your support. Our members truly appreciate it. We will prevail. I'm confident of that. Out of 1,944, we only have four people that crossed the picket line.
Joanne Powers has more labor news.
Labor unions have joined the torrent of vocal criticism directed at Donald Trump's pardoning Friday of former Maricopa County, Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Arpaio was convicted for refusing to comply with a court order to stop racial profiling practices. Unite Here, primarily representing workers in the hospitality industry, mobilized Latino voters to oust Arpaio last November after the sheriff spent years terrorizing and harassing Latino workers, regardless of immigration status. The union described the pardon as an attack on immigrants writ large and says it shows Trump's support for Arpaio's illegal police misconduct, including racial profiling and institutionalized systematic discrimination against Latino workers. Unite Here says, quote, "We are deeply troubled that Trump is pardoning criminals and sympathizing with racial bigots instead of protecting the law-abiding, tax-paying immigrant workers who make the American economy run and make this country truly great." United Farm Workers President Arturo Rodriguez also condemned Trump's action as shameful, saying, quote, "The president should not be pardoning someone who has been so vicious toward immigrants and who has openly flouted a federal judge's order to stop his racial discrimination."
WIN is made possible in part by the OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
And now, from the Rick Smith Show and the Illinois Labor History Society, it's today's Labor History in 2 minutes.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day 7,000 white and Filipino lettuce workers in California's Salinas Valley walked out on strike. Salinas was the lettuce capital of the world. The division of labor in the valley was largely ethnically based. Filipinos did much of the field labor, while whites worked in the packing sheds. At the time, Filipinos made up 40% of the total agricultural workforce in the Salinas Valley. They had founded the Filipino Labor Union a year earlier. White packing shed workers had organized into the AFL's Vegetable Packers Association. While the VPA had been reluctant to work with the FLU, they now sought to join forces in strike action. Both unions agreed neither would return to work until both had achieved victory. Together, they demanded wage increases, union recognition, and better working conditions. Losing $100,000 a day, the growers soon imported scabs of all races. They enlisted the California Highway Patrol to arrest striking Filipinos on incitement and vagrancy charges. Soon, the VPA agreed to arbitration, leaving the FLU to continue the strike alone. Some speculated the members were threatened with the loss of their charter if they refused to return to work. The striking Filipino workers continued to organize job actions and experienced increased retaliation as a result. VPA leaders publicly distanced themselves from the Filipino strikers, and racially charged vigilante violence intensified. It culminated in the burning down of the labor camp, where hundreds of Filipino workers lived a month after the strike began. Vigilantes then drove as many as 800 Filipinos from the valley at gunpoint. The strike was officially called off, and those that remained returned to work. By October, both unions had won wage increases.
A 10-day march against racism kicked off today in Charlottesville, Virginia, with the goal of covering a 112-mile route to Washington, D.C. The protest is called the March to Confront White Supremacy and was organized by a coalition of activists from organizations such as the Women's March, the Movement for Black Lives, the AFL-CIO, and Democracy Spring. The organizers are calling for the removal of all Confederate statues and monuments, for dropping the charges against those arrested for protesting the Ku Klux Klan, and the impeachment of Trump. The March to Confront White Supremacy is the latest demonstration following the August 12th rally in Charlottesville, when one woman was killed after a man drove his car into a crowd of anti-racism counter-protesters. The march began in Charlottesville's Emancipation Park, which organizers say has become the home of a modern civil rights movement. According to one of the organizers, Cassius Rudolph of People's Consortium for Human and Civil Rights, quote, "What we're trying to do is unite the country. We're standing up to confront white supremacy." Currently, over 200 people have registered for the march, which ends September 6th in the nation's capital.
On Sunday, several thousand people gathered for a rally against hate in Berkeley, California. The rally was in response to a planned right-wing protest that raised concerns and attracted police to monitor the event. The hours-long protest was peaceful until around noon, when a handful of fights broke out. Several dozen left-wing protesters encircled a handful of right-wing protesters. One member of the alt-right was also beat up by a couple of anti-fascist protesters until onlookers intercepted. Some counter-protesters were later charged with carrying banned items and with covering their faces. Joey Gibson, organizer of right-wing Patriot Prayer Rally in San Francisco, was arrested amidst the violence at the Berkeley protest. 12 others were detained shortly thereafter. In a statement, Berkeley Mayor Jesse Aragwin thanked the, quote, "thousands of people who peacefully and creatively exercise their right to freedom of speech and assembly," end quote. Sunday's rally followed a largely nonviolent march on Saturday on the other side of the bay in San Francisco. That city's mayor, Ed Lee, declared their peaceful protest as a victory.
The ACLU today filed a lawsuit against the current administration, challenging the president's directive banning transgender service members from continuing to serve in the military or receiving medically necessary health care. The president's order also bans people who are transgender from enlisting. The lawsuit was filed on behalf of the ACLU of Maryland and six current members of the U.S. Armed Forces who are transgender. The ACLU contends in its suit that the ban violates constitutional guarantees of equal protection and due process by singling out transgender individuals for unequal and discriminatory treatment. The suit argues that the ban is based on uninformed speculation, myths, stereotypes, moral disapproval, and a base desire to harm an already vulnerable group. A Defense Department review concluded in 2016 found there was no basis for the military to exclude transgender individuals from openly serving their country, subject to the same fitness requirements as other service members. That review considered and rejected the notion that medical costs, military readiness, or other factors presented any reason to discriminate against transgender service members, many of whom had already been serving with honor and silence for years.
The 1033 program is the name of the Defense Department program through which military surplus equipment is made available to local police departments around the U.S. The equipment is essentially given away to these agencies for just the cost of shipping. The 1033 program became notorious during the protests in Ferguson, Missouri, with scenes of heavily armed police in armored vehicles raising alarms among many. In response, the Obama administration put some restrictions on the program. Armored vehicles were still available, but only ones that ran on wheels, and not those that ran on tank treads. Automatic weapons and assault rifles were still available, but only those that were smaller than 50 caliber. And airplanes and drones were available, but only those that were not weaponized. This weekend, the current administration announced that it was scrapping those restrictions so that U.S. police agencies could once again obtain more powerful and extremely dangerous military equipment. While the Obama administration's restrictions were in place, the Government Accountability Office performed an investigation into the 1033 program and the Defense Logistics Agency, or DLA. GAO investigators were able to create a fictitious law enforcement agency, register it with the DLA, and order more than $1 million of equipment. The DLA never attempted to verify the agency's existence, even after the order was placed. The investigators even drove their pickup to the DLA warehouse, picked up their order without having to show any ID, then drove away with more material than they had actually ordered. While the GAO investigators did not order any weapons, the entire range of military equipment, both lethal and non-lethal, was available for them to obtain.
The White House has officially issued a pardon for Joe Arpaio, the former sheriff of Maricopa County, Arizona. This is the first pardon by the current president. Arpaio was convicted of civil contempt and criminal contempt for his department's legal detention, harassment, and racial profiling of Latin Americans. Arpaio was infamous for running an outdoor jail for years, which had been compared to a concentration camp, and for abusing people in his custody. His refusal to obey court orders and his open defiance of the law led to his conviction on charges of criminal contempt. The president reportedly asked Attorney General Jeff Sessions shortly after taking office about having the Justice Department drop the Arpaio case, but Sessions declined. Sentencing would have been October 5th, but now with this pardon, Arpaio goes free.
Now from NV1.org, it's time for National Native News with Antonia Gonzalez.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The body of a missing Fargo, North Dakota woman was found over the weekend in a river by kayakers. Police say it's Savannah LaFontaine Graywind. The 22-year-old, who was 8 months pregnant when she disappeared, had been missing for more than a week. A newborn baby was found alive last week and is believed to be Graywind's. Two people have been arrested and face kidnapping charges. Before the discovery, hundreds of people took part in search efforts for Graywind, including groups from the Native American community. The Star Tribune reports over the weekend people from the Dakotas and Minnesota helped in the search, including groups from the Turtle Mountain Reservation, where Graywind once lived. The Fargo Native American Commission also came together for a community prayer service and to offer people support. In Alaska, a rural village has banished a former village police officer from the community, but the man has not left and claims he was denied due process. KYUK's Teresa Kotsarilis reports.
On August 10th, Akiak's Tribal Council banished Jacques Cooper from their community. 43-year-old Cooper is accused of bootlegging and selling marijuana. Local leaders say they've collected a series of sworn statements against him, but Cooper denies the allegations and remains in town. Last week, Akiak residents angrily confronted Cooper at his home and then live-streamed that confrontation on Facebook.
We are banished from Akiak. And you can come back.
We can ban anyone for... The tribe can ban anyone.
Banishment is a traditional punishment in some Alaska Native communities that can be controversial. In an email exchange this week, the state's Assistant Attorney General, Corey Mills, wrote that, quote, banishment orders can present difficult constitutional issues that have to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis. Jacques Cooper claims that he didn't know about his own banishment order until it was issued, and that no evidence has been presented against him. He also says that Akiak residents have threatened him. Local leaders deny this and say that Cooper will get a proper hearing on his banishment if he requests one. For KYUK, I'm Teresa Kotsarilis.
A personal finance website has ranked Minnesota's Leech Lake Tribal College number one in the nation for overall quality. WalletHub looked at price, faculty-student ratio, and graduation rates, among other factors, in its ranking of more than 700 schools. In Minnesota, most community colleges cost a little more than $5,000 a year for full-time students. Leech Lake's interim president, Pat Brooker, says the school stands out because of its family feel, its ability to be both a safe haven and a launching pad for students.
They can come and build strong relationships in this very stimulating environment whereby we present a number of opportunities for them to explore as they make decisions about their life on into the future.
The college was established by the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe and has campuses in Cass Lake and Red Lake. The University of Illinois will no longer allow a war chant at sporting events. The university's India mascot, Chief Alinewick, has long been retired after it was found to be offensive by the National Collegiate Athletic Association about a decade ago. But the war chant has continued. The Chicago Tribune reports Native American groups are applauding the decision, while some fans are not happy to see the music end. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
The evidence of suspicious ties between Trump and the Russian government keeps pouring in. The New York Times obtained emails today from Felix Sater, a Russian-born real estate broker working for the Trump campaign in 2015. The emails indicate Sater's willingness to use a deal with Russian President Vladimir Putin as a way to help Trump get elected. In one email, Sater wrote, "Our boy can become president of the USA and we can engineer it. I'll get all of Putin's team to buy in on this. I'll manage this process." The emails were sent to Trump's lawyer Gary Cohn, attempting to broker a deal to build a Trump Tower in Moscow. In an additional story today, the Washington Post reported that Cohn reached out to a top aide to Putin for help on the deal. Cohn wrote in an email to Putin's press secretary, "As this project is too important, I am hereby requesting your assistance. I respectfully request someone, preferably you, contact me so that I might discuss the specifics as well as arranging meetings with the appropriate individuals. I thank you in advance for your assistance and look forward to hearing from you soon." According to Cohn, neither he nor Trump ended up traveling to Moscow to pursue the deal.
The bodies of all 10 sailors killed in the most recent U.S. Navy collision now have been recovered, according to a spokesperson for the 7th Fleet. The USS McCain, an Arleigh Burke-class destroyer named after the grandfather and father of Arizona Senator John McCain, was struck by a giant tanker ship in the Strait of Malacca in an echo of a previous deadly incident just months before. The sailors were crushed and drowned as they were pinned by deformed metal under the waterline. The Navy's top admiral has ordered a review of the entire fleet's procedures in light of the collision. Speculation in the U.S. press has pointed to possible GPS spoofing as the cause of the incident, but the verification website Snopes points out that there is no hard evidence for that idea. An article in Philly.com notes that a GPS spoofing incident has been reported by a Russian commander, in which his ship and others nearby were led astray by an errant signal. But there was no such widespread confusion in the two U.S. ship collisions. This does not eliminate the possibility of on-ship sabotage. For the moment, although the investigations continue, the collisions are being laid to human error, and procedures are being reviewed and revamped to prevent further such incidents.
Israeli soldiers on Sunday abducted 9 Palestinians in the occupied area of West Bank. The victims, some of who were children, were taken from their homes. Many other homes were also forcefully invaded and searched by Israeli forces. Following these incidents, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu released a statement that he will not remove Israeli settlements in the West Bank. These settlements have proven to be a core issue in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The Israeli Security Agency has been reporting on the rise of the Revolt Movement, a new generation Jewish extremist group. The group has been blamed for recent abductions and arson attacks against Palestinians in the West Bank. The Revolt Movement is quickly gaining members, with many of its recruits aged 16 to 25. Since the beginning of this year, the Israeli government has issued 47 administrative orders against members of Revolt, 28 of who are still active. Only 5 members of the group have been arrested.
a scientific expedition conducting the largest study ever on the health of the ocean's coral reefs has released a preliminary report stating the vast majority of the world's coral reefs are currently undergoing major bleaching events. Coral bleaching occurs when increasingly warm waters cause corals to expel the algae living in their tissues, causing the coral to turn white. While the bleaching itself does not kill the coral, it greatly weakens the coral, leading to mortality rate as high as 50% as the coral slowly starves itself to death. Last year, an analysis on the Great Barrier Reef off the coast of Australia showed 90% of that reef to be undergoing coral bleaching. The scientists are halfway through the two-year study, and the final report is expected to be released in 2019.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Teresa Mitchell, Consul Dolma, Ken Jones, and Don Zer. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Our engineer is Mike Fotoklis. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelis Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Natalie Mahdi. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, the Abe and Joe Talk radio show cover politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener calls. At 9, on Alternative Radio, the Baffler magazine editor Thomas Frank looks at how this became the country that voted for Trump. At 10, Eric Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, onstage and studio host Susanna Mars visits with the Portland Institute for Contemporary Art. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Joseph Gallivan brings you part one of his special on the 2017 Time-Based Art Festival. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. KBOO keeps you informed and involved, and we need your help. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. Good night, Ken. Good night, Mike.
Good night, Natalie. Good night, Mike. Good night, Rosalyn.
Good night.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Big Chill Benefit, Sunday, September 10th at the Bit House Saloon in Portland. The Big Chill Benefit is a fundraiser for Stephen Mitchell, aka DJ Chill, a person known for his support of local Portland artists. Funds will go towards DJ Chill's recovery after being injured in a major car accident earlier this year. Again, that's the Big Chill Benefit, Sunday, September 10th at the Bit House Saloon, 727 Southeast Grand Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hi, KBOO members. Join us at the KBOO annual meeting on Saturday, September 9th from 10:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. The annual meeting is an opportunity for our members to come together, hear a report about the state of the station, and celebrate our community. This year, the meeting is dedicated to Michael Wells, who tragically passed on earlier this summer. As we celebrate the legacy of Michael, we will listen to some of the youth who contribute to our community and to what it means to follow their leadership. We hope to see you on Saturday, September 9th, from 10:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. That's 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland.
K KBU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Ingenio Milagro Playfest, Friday, September 8th through Sunday, September 10th at the Milagro Theater in Portland. The Ingenio Milagro Playfest will feature four plays by Latinx playwrights and a concert readings over 3 days after a short rehearsal period. The playwrights will also get to work with the guest artist Daniel Jacquez. Again, that's Ingenio Milagro Playfest, Friday, September 8th through Sunday, September 10th at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Massage and Wellness Weekend, Saturday, September 9th and Sunday, September 10th at the Oregon School of Massage in Portland. Massage and Wellness Weekend is a weekend of celebration of holistic living, community engagement, and massage. Free events including community education classes and continuing education for massage therapists. Again, that's Massage and Wellness Weekend, Saturday, September 9th and Sunday, September 10th at the Oregon School of Massage, 9500 Southwest Barber Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 6 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's time for Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class, the only show of its type in Oregon or Southwest Washington. I'm Jamie Partridge, your host, and my guest, one of my guests tonight is Alyssa Pagan, who blew into town in the last couple weeks from New York City, well, actually Minneapolis, and ended up participating on August 17th with dozens of transgender folk and allies on the Bureau of Labor Industries to demand an end to employment discrimination for transgender workers.